time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for May 30th, 2020. Wow, end of May. That's just crazy. First off, I'd like to apologize for a glitch in last week's on-air show. I had some technical issues and wasn't able to upload it in time for on-air Saturday morning. My guests were Lee Katz, who's been in the bike business for 55 years. Lee is one of the driving forces behind Turin Bike Shops in Illinois and Colorado, as well as the developer of a lot of product lines, including Lake Sport. It's a nice reminiscing conversation. My second guest was George Liu. He's a PhD candidate at Eindhoven University in the Netherlands, but he's sort of stuck at home in Canada for the time being. His thesis is about bicycle highways, and his passion for bicycle transportation is palpable even over the mic. If you'd like to hear the show, log on to OutspokenCyclist.com and click the May 23rd link. So let's move on to this week's show. I believe that life in the time of COVID-19 has changed us all in a lot of ways and perhaps for the better. Today, I'm happy to be able to share the conversation I had earlier this week with Strongtown's director, Chuck Marone. His vision of what cities need to be livable, desirable, and successful is always uplifting and informative, and now his ideas and philosophy are more essential than ever. Before we speak with Chuck, though, I invited Zach Paschak, the president of Detroit Bikes, back to the show. If you've been looking for a bike, especially for recreation or commuting, you may find that the cupboards are bare at many bike shops around the country. The shops are empty because the suppliers' warehouses are empty, for the first time in many years, by the way. And in fact, some people are seeing what is being called a mini bike boom. So I wanted to talk with Zach because A, he's a manufacturer here in the U.S., and B, he has a great head on his shoulders when it comes to the bike business. Hi, Zach. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. I hope all is well in Detroit.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
I'm not certain that my listeners know exactly what's happening in the bicycle industry. You know, I'm plugged in a different way. You're plugged in a different way. The last 4 to 5 months have been so strange. So I'd like to go back to the first of the year with you, let's say January, and tell us what you were thinking then about the 2020 cycling season.
Well, you know, I personally felt pretty good about it because of our contract with Dick's Sporting Goods. We had just started tooling up a new production line to do the assembly work on their Colorado bikes, and then, you know, hopefully expand into other Nishiki bikes that they sell. So I was pretty excited. And also we had some other kind of bigger contract orders in line. I didn't necessarily think it would be, you know, what it's turned into for our brand. I was kind of more excited about contract work. But yeah, you know, I felt like 2020 was going to be a pretty good year.
Yeah, and it has turned out to be really good for Detroit Bikes, which is awesome. When did you start to see things changing?
Well, so it was the night that the NBA closed down that I decided I would stay in my house for the next, you know, for the foreseeable future. And that was early March, I think. And then by mid to late March, we started seeing bike orders just start spiking after the first week or so, 10 days maybe, that people had been inside their houses. I think a lot of people just really wanted to start riding bikes. And so over the last year or two, I've been working really hard on making Detroit Bikes more consumer friendly as like a direct to consumer company. So put a lot of time into optimizing the website and getting getting that to be as nice a shopping experience as possible for people, and working on packaging and making sure bikes could show up at people's houses in a way that would be really easy for them to put together and get riding. And so all that work kind of just got concentrated into a big payoff, you know, that happened in this crazy run of, you know, 2.5-3 months where you just can't keep a bike on the shelf. We sold out of every single thing we have in our building, to the point where, you know, I'm finding old inventory and like dead inventory, projects that didn't get started that we're just kind of throwing together, you know, to make a bike that we can get down to our retail store. So we've got something there that that they can sell, you know, from our store. The online orders sort of cleaned out all our inventory in the building.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Zach Paschak. He is the president of Detroit Bikes up in Michigan, not too far from me. And we are hearing the words bike boom a lot in our industry. I'm not sure it's the kind of bike boom we had hoped for, but I guess, as my one friend from Michigan used to say, the only good bike is a sold bike, that it's not all bad. Yeah, he was one of my reps. He was just one of the coolest guys ever. Anyway, so is there a backlog of orders right now?
Well, no, I kind of just had to shut down orders. When we sold out a product, I'm doing some pre-orders, but we're letting people know we don't really expect those to be fulfilled until sometime around August. So, you know, and still we're having a lot of people put down deposits on those pre-orders. And then, yeah, I mean, we are backlogged on our American-made bikes, our USC line, but we're still in production. So we got the crew back working about 2 weeks ago. We're back up to about 25, 30 people in the building. So we're just kind of able to turn the gas back on and get cooking. But certainly it's, there's a lot to get to for us. We're under a tremendous amount of, pressure here. And, you know, it's great, you know, it's to sell a product that everybody wants is a great spot to be in, for sure.
For sure. So let's talk hypothetical for a second. People are suggesting that this is a bicycle boom of some sort, whether it's for transportation, recreation, health, well-being, all of that. Do you think people who have bought bikes, who are going to buy bikes, who are anticipating buying a bike, will continue to stick with it as things open back up? I know public transportation is not something people are looking forward to, and I'm not sure exactly who is buying your bicycles. But do you think people will stick with riding and walking?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. That's the hope. I mean, I send out an email to all of our subscribers for Detroit Bikes, and on one of the emails, I wanted to bring up that very point. You know, once this is all done and life changes to what it's going to change into, I don't know if normal is the right word, but I do hope that people will remember the joy that bicycles brought them, you know, in this time when they were feeling, you know, cooped up and uncomfortable and wanting to do something that felt good. I hope that they remember that riding a bike makes you feel pretty good. And I think that they will. I mean, a lot of my customers are, you know, their first time adult cyclists. They haven't ridden a bike since they were a kid. And I'm getting, you know, pretty wonderful emails from people who are just so happy that they bought a bike and are, you know, are enjoying getting out and about. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think this is sustainable. I mean, I don't think we're going to continue to have this kind of demand. It should be fulfilled at some point here, to some degree. We'll go back to a bit more sense of normal, but there will be a heck of a lot more cyclists out there, and hopefully they'll be getting out and using the infrastructure that's being invested in by cities across the country, you know, all those bike lanes that are being put in. I hope this creates a bit more use of them, because I think the more that they're used, the more that they get built, and that becomes a pretty nice self-perpetuating, you know, mission for cyclists.
Well, that brings me to pretty much what my last question is, and that is about, and we can use Detroit as an example because you're right there, and that is, how do you think cities are going to respond to, and is Detroit responding to, you alluded to that, making changes in infrastructure to either shut down some streets, some thoroughfares to automobiles except for essential traffic like police, fire, and deliveries, or open up more streets to cycling or walking. And then in response to all of that, how the economy will respond to that, having people closer to the stores in some way.
Yeah, I think I've always, you know, made the case that bikes are great for the local economy. You're far more likely to shop when you're on a bike. You know, you're going to hop off that bike and buy a juice, or, you know, you see a sandwich store and go check it out. Whatever it is, it just connects you more to street level retail. And that's provable. I mean, I think that's just basically an accepted fact that, you know, when you're driving through a city, you're far less likely to stop and spend money. So they are great for business. And then in terms of the infrastructure investment, you know, Detroit has been doing a great job. It's maybe not a city that urban planners think of, or I guess urban planners might know, but, you know, people who think of Detroit probably don't think, hey, that's a place where they're doing some great urban planning. But it is. You know, we have a really great mayor and mayor's office and great municipal staff who've been here for previous mayors as well. But included in that is a really excellent city planning department in Detroit that has done just incredible work, especially over the last 5 to 10 years. And they're doing a great job making the city far more bike friendly. There's local activists like Todd Scott, done a great job with trails in the city and finding ways to make things happen with, like, the Dequindre Cut is a big bike trail here in Detroit in the city that connects, you know, the Eastern Market to the riverfront and beyond. And so there's some really cool stuff going on. And it's, you know, that I think that's happening in pretty much every city in the country. You know, you take a trip to Minneapolis, you're going to see some pretty cool bike infrastructure. Chicago's got all kinds of great stuff. Obviously, Portland was probably the front runner on a lot of this stuff, and I think is a pretty great bike friendly town. So it's pretty great to see. But I do believe that we're still really on the front side of this too. I think we're going to continue to see more cycling infrastructure. I mean, living in a city where you can bike to get around, it just is a really good quality of life. And I think citizens are wanting that. There's, you know, maybe at first it was kind of fringe cyclists, you know, people in spandex kind of fighting against traffic and yelling at cars and stuff like that, like having to ride, you know, in that sea of kind of frightening traffic. But we're moving now. It's becoming something that's more accepted, and more types of people are getting involved, and it's becoming something where you don't need to be, you know, out there like on the front lines, like a, you know, like you're fighting a war to ride your bike around a city. I think people are trying to make it something where you can, you know, you can feel more safe and secure as you do that. And it's pretty great to see. And like I said, I think it's going to continue to grow.
We can only hope. And I think you're right. We've been talking with Zach Paschak. He is the president of Detroit Bikes, clearly up in Detroit, Michigan. Stay well, stay safe. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me, and congratulations on just having a great season.
Thanks so much, Diane.
All right, you take care. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Chuck Marone is the director of Strong Towns. I always come away from a conversation with Chuck feeling there is hope for a better and more sustainable future. So let's head on out to Minnesota to talk with Chuck about what people, cities, and government might just look to be doing going forward. Hi, Chuck. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's always good to talk with you. How are you?
Hey, it's really nice to be here. Thank you. I'm doing fantastic. It's summer in Minnesota now, and it's beautiful, and nothing could be better.
Right. It is summer. It's summer here, too. I'm very happy to see green and flowers. It's awesome.
we get, we get a very pronounced four seasons. And so we embrace summer with a gusto. So yeah, as soon as it reaches 35 degrees, we're out in shorts and sandals and, right. don't look back.
35 degrees. That would be Fahrenheit. Uh huh. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
We actually didn't have winter here in Cleveland. It was just kind of a gray, cold, miserable winter, very little snow, almost no snow, and it never really got really, really cold. But I know you guys probably did have snow. I've talked to some people from out there, and you did have a real winter.
We had a beautiful winter, actually. It didn't really get the deep, deep freeze we get sometimes. And we got lots and lots of snow, and we got it early and in plentiful amounts. So
nice.
It's a great season for recreation, that's no doubt.
Well, I know you've been really busy over the past few months. I wanted to catch up on some of the things you're doing and seeing. What's going on with Strong Towns right now? I know you just had a member drive, and how did that go?
Yeah, well, the member drive went fantastic. People are very, very generous to us. You know, a lot of what we do at Strong Towns involves, I mean, all of it involves communicating a message. But a big deal of my personal work is going out traveling and meeting with people and having talks and giving lectures and workshops and helping people in a very personal way understand the Strong Towns message. And of course, you know, we've been at stay-at-home orders. Internally, our board has said no more travel until we get to a point where we feel comfortable doing that. And so that whole aspect of our mission, really the evangelical part of what we do, was kneecapped for a while. And we got up and running very quickly as we could, a bunch of kind of supplemental ways to do that, including, you know, web broadcasts, additional podcasts. We even launched this thing we call the Strong Towns Academy. We've got a 4.5-hour course on there for free for people to get like a 101 on Strong Towns ideas. And so we've kept very busy, but it's been a adapt on the fly, just like a lot of people are in these days.
Right, right. It's so weird. It's just weird. So
It is weird.
I mean, I have a yoga studio, and I'm the only one in it with a great big television now. So I do all my classes by Zoom. And while on the one hand, it's really been wonderful to be able to reach out to people and have them log on and join classes, it's pretty lonely in the studio all by myself and my plants. You know, it's just us. But, you know, it is what it is.
I empathize. I have two daughters that are teenage girls, 13 and 15, and they do dance together. And I'll give you the other side of the looking glass here. These are two girls who, you know, because of their age and what have you, I won't say they're competitive, but they're at the age where they teenage squabble, right?
Right.
So they started doing dance lessons remotely. They watch them and they participate. They would kind of squabble during class. Like, they didn't want the teacher to put them in formations anywhere near each other. When they first started doing the at home, they were in different rooms, different parts of the house, different streams. They migrated over time to doing it together because they found that bond and they enjoyed it. And now they do all their classes together in one room. And when they get done, they talk about it to each other. And it's been fun to watch. And so it's different. And, you know, I think the benefit from getting back to normal, but there has been a lot of bonding and good on the other side of the camera that comes out in some of these things.
Very interesting. Let me remind listeners, I'm speaking with Chuck Marone. He is the founder and director of Strong Towns. We talk to him quite often, and probably not often enough, but because it's always something new that you're doing and exciting. So I want to know how the pandemic, with the shutdown of schools and recreation and work, how is it changing the way cities are going to need to look at transportation and planning choices? What are you seeing?
There's an immediate need that I think a lot of, you know, most cities to some degree or another have struggled with. Stay-at-home orders are brutal. And, you know, I think we've seen now with kind of just, especially in my part of the world, with this kind of public pushback against them, the fact that, you know, psychologically humans are not designed to stay at home for months. You know, just our brains don't work that way. One of the successful relief valves that we saw cities do and that we were encouraging cities to do was to take a lot of the infrastructure that had been given over to automobiles and was not being used for those purposes now, repurpose that and open it up exclusively for people. We have tons of space on our streets that are not being utilized today. And cities, we've seen, you know, many places dedicate a lot of that space now to people to be out so they can walk, they can keep, you know, a safe distance away from each other, yet appreciate or participate in kind of the social aspects of being human. This is a public health issue as much from an exercise standpoint as it is from a mental standpoint, maybe even more from a mental standpoint. And so that just repurposing of the things we built on the fly has been a huge shift. I think also now we're seeing, you know, with the desire to get businesses back open again, and understanding that we can take some of this space and give that over to restaurants, to stores, to other places to expand out into the public realm. If you go to, you know, any developing country, this is what they do anyway. They don't have the money to waste on, you know, exclusively for streets for cars. They have to use all this public space for many uses. And we're rediscovering now in hardship that these are great public spaces. We can set out tables. We can, you know, display our wares. We can do this stuff in ways that, from a public health standpoint, allow people to be in the space. And from a commerce standpoint, allows us also to continue to function and operate, which is also really, really important.
You said open the streets for people. You didn't say open the streets just for bicycles or for walking, for skateboarding, for whatever it is, but for people. And I think that's an interesting distinction that you're saying people sort of instead of cars and taxis and buses, but public transportation seems to have been impacted also because now, of course, people aren't going to ride buses or trains. So how important is it going to be for cities to look at this going forward? I mean, are they going to keep these streets open? Are we going to be able to continue to walk and bike and do the things on our own, socially distanced, after everybody says, well, even after we have a vaccine, for example?
Yeah, this is a difficult one. And I'm not going to pretend that I know, what the future will bring. I will say that transit is having a difficult conversation right now. Transit advocates, particularly, are struggling because it would be nice to be able to convince people that, you know, riding the bus is safe and riding the subway is safe and getting on a light rail line is safe. And, you know, I think some of those arguments are compelling from a, you know, a medical standpoint that if we're wearing masks and we're distanced and what have you. That being said, people just won't do it. I mean, transit has always been a struggle because of the way we have built our system to get, you know, optional riders to use it. We've made driving so convenient. We've made driving actually more convenient. We make transit systems really difficult to use and, mostly very inconvenient in this country. And so there's a huge bias in favor of the person who will get in their vehicle and drive somewhere. You know, you layer on the fact that people are feeling vulnerable and less safe from a biological standpoint in transit, and it creates this huge burden. If our neighborhoods were configured differently, this wouldn't be a problem because on a bike, you can get to anywhere you need to go within a neighborhood in a very reasonable amount of time. Walking, you can get most places within a neighborhood in a reasonable amount of time. It's the fact that we've created ourselves as this commuter lifestyle where, you know, you would have a job 40 minutes away from where you would live and that would be an optimum setting in our society that creates this viral transmission problem, and also just this like work-life balance problem. I think a lot of these transit systems, just like our development patterns, need to adapt to a more neighborhood scale. You can think of a city as a collection of many, many kind of self-sufficient neighborhoods. as being like an optimal approach. The closer we can adapt to that, the more we can meet people's needs without them having to cross over, in a sense, transmission boundaries into other places and, allow people the option to drive or to take transit, but also they can have a viable life using a bike or just walking.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chuck Marone. He's with Strong Towns. He is Mr. Strong Towns. We're talking about transit, but I want to go back to something that you always talk about, and that is cities, and especially now, states and cities, are already looking at financial hardship. How do you think the pandemic will change any of that financial hardship going forward when we're talking about building roads or reconstructing roads or bridges or, let's say, bicycle infrastructure?
So let's go back 4 months.
Okay.
If we just go back 4 months and you asked me to give a diagnosis on the fiscal health of our cities, I would have said it's a disaster. It's like a looming, pending disaster.
Right.
We have massive amounts of infrastructure, deferred maintenance, huge backlogs. We lack the financial productivity to maintain this stuff. We have these huge ongoing legacy commitments. And really, we have an economy that has been centralized to kind of give the facade of growth, this veneer of prosperity over top of something that as soon as you get down to the neighborhood level, you see is very, very desperate in many places. Now come back to today. What has happened is that all those fault lines have just been laid bare. The things that we could kind of excuse away or maybe chalk up to, if we just get a little bit more growth or if we can get some aid and assistance or what have you, we can burst through this and find our way to, prosperity. That illusion is gone and it's disappearing. And I think, most local leaders that I have spoken to in the past 2 months recognize that we're not going to recover in the sense that we're going to go back to, what things were like in January of 2020. We're going to transform into something new, something different. I think that creates both a level of opportunity and a level of fear and apprehension in us. Will what we transfer to be better? Will it be more stable? Will it provide us a platform where we can start to build prosperity? I think that's an open question. And, when we look at cities, I feel like the ones that are having the conversation around how do we prop up existing systems? How do we extend what we have? How do we get back to, doing what we were doing 6 months ago? I think those places are in for a harsh, harsh awakening. I think the ones that are saying, okay, we knew we had to make some changes. Now we've had the heart attack. It's time to clean up our eating habits. It's time to clean up our exercise, start exercising. Basically, use it as the wake-up call to mobilize people and to get them moving as a community in the direction that we need to go in. I think those places are poised to be like the leaders of what could quite literally be not only the next 2 or 3 decades, but the next century. I think these are cities that can differentiate themselves in a big way right now and come out. It's hard to say this in the midst of the difficulty, but come out the winners in this transition. And that can include places like Cleveland. That can include places like mine, a small town in central Minnesota. And it can include, cities of all sizes. I think there's an opportunity right now to differentiate ourselves in many ways.
We're talking with Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. A great conversation. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Go back to the beginning. So do you see that perhaps infrastructure dollars will be channeled to some of the projects that will, A, put some people to work in ways that maybe they hadn't worked in the past, you know, sort of a WPA kind of thing where you suddenly have projects that nobody ever thought of that will now transform these cities into places people are comfortable living and traveling in?
You know what? There's a part of me that hopes not, and I'll explain that. I feel like, you know, at the macro level, we talk about this as like the Great Depression. What are the lessons we learned from the Great Depression? Well, you know, let's pump a bunch of money in the economy. Let's bail out all the businesses, you know, and you see that happening at the federal level. But then there's also this idea that, you know, we can have a new WPA, a new CCC. We can get people out there working and building things, and wouldn't it be great? And I get that. I do think that that is the generals fighting the last war. When we look at our economy today and we compare it to where we were at in 1930, in 1930, we didn't have the interstate highway system. We didn't have everybody with a paved cul-de-sac in front of their house. We didn't have cities that, you know, cities were 10% of the size they were today with larger populations than they have now. We weren't spread out. We hadn't built trillions and trillions of dollars of unproductive infrastructure. The idea that we would, and this is, you know, a bill being floated right now, these are ideas being put forth, that we would pump trillions of dollars into infrastructure programs running through the same exact systems that we have now, to me, this would be a disaster. Because for every dollar you got of a separated bike lane or a sidewalk connection in a vital neighborhood, you would get $100, $200, $500 of the worst kind of frontage road interchange, nasty, you know, soul sucking, you know, budget wrecking infrastructure you could possibly imagine. We've advocated for, if we're going to do some type of bailout for cities, don't wander it through an infrastructure program. Just give them money. Local leaders, a lot of them have messed up ideas of what needs to happen. And a lot of them will do things that are really dumb. But a lot of them will do things that are really, really bright. And at the local level, we have an opportunity, if we are actually making the decisions happen there, to have real people and real urgent needs influence what is done, as opposed to just running them through these top-down infrastructure programs that we can clearly see what they deliver. They deliver suboptimal results immediately. And over the long term, they give us these huge liabilities for maintenance that we have demonstrated for decades now we can't meet. So I hope we don't go that route. I hope we are more innovative than that. And I hope we don't fight the last war, but recognize where we're at today.
So where would that, I understand it has to start in your local community, but where, starting with the dollars, who's going to say that that's a way to look at it? Are there states looking at that? Are there communities looking at that? Is any place in the federal government looking at the possibility of saying, locally, these people can figure it out?
I think that it works differently than that.
Okay.
And here's the moment I think we're in. If we look, and I'm going to say this, and I think, you know, for people listening today, take whatever political partisan, you know, inclinations you have and just try to suppress it for a minute, because what I'm going to say is not a partisan thing. If we look at the federal response to this pandemic, I think we might all be able to agree that at the very least, it's been clumsy. It's not been well coordinated. There's no real vision for what that is. And there is, in a sense, a leadership void to be filled. We see governors stepping in, and we see great Republican governors, and we see great Democrat governors stepping in and being leaders in this time period. But even there, there is a disconnect. There's a leadership void. When you get down to the block level, when you get to the local level, when you start walking and experiencing life in neighborhoods today, there's a disconnect between, you know, what a stay-at-home edict in Minnesota would be for a city like mine versus what it would be for a city like Minneapolis, what it would be for a third-ring suburb, you know, what it would be for a mining community in northern Minnesota. You know, that local nuance is essentially a void laid bare now because of this crisis. I think it is an opportunity, and what we see is a lot of local leaders stepping in and filling that void. And so it's less coming down to, will the federal government devolve power? Will the state government give locals more say and more authority? Will dollars like trickle down, or will they come through these programs? And what we see is that local leaders are actually stepping up and saying, I am responsible for this community. I am going to lead. I am going to tell people in different levels of government what we need here in this place. And we're just going to take action. I think that our systems are naturally evolving to where they should be, which is more flat, more horizontally oriented, more oriented towards people and their urgent needs, as opposed to looking at local government as a vertical element of a ecosystem of governments where the feds give direction to the state gives direction to the local government, and the local governments just administer. I think it's starting to work the other way, and that's the way it needs to go.
I love it. And so I want to see sort of results. I want to see that happening. We are in the midst of an election cycle that could make some of these changes. I'm wondering where you're going to go with strong towns to begin to encourage that. And do you have like ways of making this happen? Do you see that there might be a playbook for this?
Actually, it's funny that you would ask. You asked me before what we're up to. I forgot to mention, last week we released the Local Leaders Toolkit, a Strong Towns Guide to Responding to the Pandemic. And it is three different sections. The first section is, here's the stuff we need to do immediately in the first 30 days, 60 days, like stuff we need to do right now. Let's get people fed. Let's get people shelter. Let's get our streets open. Let's redirect our law enforcement to be more, you know, educational. There's a bunch of things for us to do immediately. Then we've got a midterm set of strategies. Here's what we do over the coming year to position ourselves for this transformation. And then the third section is, here's what we look to do beyond a year. Here are the things we're setting ourselves up to start to accomplish. I think right now there's an urgency among cities to get going. And as I said earlier, I think the ones that identify or recognize what is going on now and position themselves to react to it and resist this notion that we're just going to prop up the old way of doing things, I think those are the ones that will emerge as leaders. We see right now, you know, you look historically at cities and, you know, we can see this phase of development where when Europeans first came to North America, it was all the ports that were the important places, the Baltimores and Boston and Philadelphia. And then, you know, we evolved to where it was the places along the Mississippi River. And then all of a sudden it was the places along the Great Lakes when we had the steel, you know, the Industrial Revolution here. We're manufacturing steel. Now we've gone to, you know, these mega cities, the New York and the San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And where can we aggregate these brilliant minds? I think we see with the changes in technology, whether it's things like Zoom and you know, something as simple as email, your ability to work remotely. But I think you're also seeing now just the idea that people are choosing nice places to live, that we don't have a geographic constraint. You don't have to be on an ocean. You don't have to be on a port. You don't have to be on a major rail line to be a successful city. You just have to be a nice place to live. And we can do that at many different scales, at a very small town, at a very big city, and everything in between. And so to me, like, the successful cities of the future are going to be the ones that take the steps right now to differentiate themselves and make themselves into pleasant places to live.
Wow. Okay, then.
Yeah. You know, I mean, in terms of your conversation, you and I.
Yes.
the biking and walking aspect of this is monumental, particularly because, you know, when you're looking at a country with double-digit unemployment and unemployment that is skyrocketing, you know, we need people to be able to get around without having to spend $9,000 a year on a car. We have to be able to have families adapt to this by saying, we're going to go down to one car, or we're going to go down to no cars. And we can still live, or we can live an even better life, but we can at least live a very good, prosperous life without having to be dependent on spending $9,000 or $18,000 for two cars of our income each year on just, you know, the ante to participate in society. If we can adjust our cities to make that happen, all that capital is now freed up to be put to work for families, for small businesses, for neighborhoods, in ways that, you know, give people lots of options. And I think in a time where we're going to be struggling financially, and we are going to struggle financially, I think, for a long time through this, the way you differentiate yourself is you make your place walkable, you make your place bikeable, and you give people options to improve their quality of life while spending less money. That's what success now looks like.
Yes, it does. And I, this whole idea that you have to get in your car and travel through traffic to get to a place to sit at a desk all day and then get in your car and travel to go back home and not have dinner till 8 or 9 at night because you were stuck in traffic for an hour and a half is taking away from the quality of life in such a stark way now. I think people are seeing something they've never seen if they are young enough not, you know, to only be working the last, say, 15 years or less. You know, things have changed so much since I was in high school and then college. Things just weren't like this. And it's like such a huge wake-up call.
Yes. Well, and right now what we've done is we've demonstrated that this can work. You look at the professional class in this country, and I think we could have a long conversation about essential workers.
Yeah.
You know, but let's look at the professional class in this country, which really, and we could be critical of this, and I am in many ways, have driven the development agenda of this country for 2.5, 3 generations. If you look at the professional class in this country, there was a sense 2 months ago that we needed to have large office buildings and large clusters of people and people commuting in from distant regions into a center, and that the only way we could be productive, and this was even in places like Silicon Valley, where, you know, you have created these remote working tools. I have lots of friends that work in San Francisco and work in the Valley, and, you know, their places were demanding that they be present in an office.
Right.
And, you know, they were very insistent that that's the only way we're productive. To a person now, they are telling me we're never going back. And not only are we never going back, we're more productive this way. Strong Towns has always been a remote operation. We have 11 of us working for Strong Towns. You know what we do instead of paying office space? We give everybody a little bit of money to help defray their home computer and internet and cell phone costs. But then twice a year, we get together at a Disney theme park. And we have our staff meeting and we have a great time out and we enjoy each other's company and we get a lot done. And then in between that, we've used Zoom for years and we meet remotely. It is ridiculously productive and everybody gets to live in a nice place where they want. Everybody gets to, you know, have the lifestyle they want. And instead of wasting our money on office space that no one wants to be in, we spend it on churros and, you know, a theme park ride. And really nice meals when we're together. It is a much better life. And you could make that case 3 months ago, and it was kind of theoretical.
Right.
Now we've proven it. We've shown it. We've given it to people. And I think a lot of people are just not going back. They're just not, you know, I'm not going back to that.
I already know that that's true.
Well, and let's even pretend that we try to go back, right? Like we prop it up and we go back. One of the amazing things that's happened now, and you see this even with the smog being, you know, reduced and the, you know, all these other like environmental effects that have now happened. What we've done is we've shown people a glimpse of something different. And that itself becomes like a virus. It becomes like an intellectual contagion that you can't undo. You know, the fact that I have these two daughters I mentioned earlier, and, you know, life in January and February involved them going to school, me going, you know, driving out. I mean, I can walk back and forth to my office. I do every day, but I would have to go home and get the car and drive out to the school and get them and drive them to dance and pick them up from dance and bring them back to dance. And, you know, I was putting lots of time behind the wheel, and it was not fun time. It was not engaging time. All of a sudden now I'm home with these kids all the time. I'm having like this, you know, renaissance. The first couple of weeks were fun. The second couple of weeks was a little tense. And now we've settled into this beautiful routine where we all are thoroughly enjoying each other's company in ways we haven't since they were little kids. I can't imagine my wife going back to work full time at her office where she was working. I'm actually not looking forward to school starting in the fall if the kids have to go back. So we've done something here that at the very least is culturally going to change the influencing class of the country. And I think that, you know, the profound effects from that, it's too early to predict, but I think that they will be profound.
And I think they'll be profound upward into government, into it'll go community, state, you know, and all the way up to the federal government. I think everything will have to change. I don't think anybody is going to look at this and say, oh, we can go back to being fill in the blank. Because once right. you taste it, it's like, you know, well, I already had a bite of this. I don't want to give it up. Wow. So.
Yeah.
So where are you going from here? What's the next thing? I do want to find out, and I do want to let people know how they can get the local leaders toolkit. And I want to make sure that we stay in touch, because I think that things are, once they start to open up, things are going to change quickly in some ways. They won't in others, but I want to make sure that as things start to move forward that, you know, we're still dialed in to what Strong Towns is doing.
Do you want me to give you the big announcement?
Of course, if you're willing to share it with me, hell yeah.
Well, I have not announced this yet. And I actually, we'll probably do it, we'll probably roll it out here in the next few weeks. But I just got the final cover today. So I feel like maybe we can start announcing this. And since you and I have done this a number of times now, this feels like a good place to let you know. So last October, Wiley Publishing released the book, Strong Towns, The Bottom-Up Revolution to
right.
Rebuild American Prosperity.
Which we reviewed. You and book. I did that. Yeah.
Yes. Well, book number two is going to come out next year. I've signed a contract in December. We now have the cover. It's going to go to the publisher here in a few months. I've got a lot of work to do yet, but we're going to get there. It's all about transportation. It's called Confessions of a Recovering Engineer. A Strong Towns approach to transportation, and it will be available for pre-order within the next couple months. So that's the big thing that I'm working on is, you know, the whole transportation conversation and how it's changing and how it needs to change. And as an organization, you know, we're just trying to be of service to people. We're getting inundated with requests because people are seeing this as an opportunity and trying to change. That toolkit is available at strongtowns.org/toolkit. And it might not be at this very instant that you and I are talking, but I know by the end of the day it will be. So strongtowns.org/toolkit is where we're putting that permanently and, you know, to make that available for free to everybody who wants it.
You guys are doing such great work. And I
thank you.
I get emails from you all the time, and they're always so enlightening. I wouldn't say I started out this way. So this podcast will be 10 years old in September. And
oh, congratulations.
Thank you. We just passed the 500 episode mark last month.
Wow.
I know.
Yeah, that's great.
It's crazy. But I can see if I were to go back and sort of graph the episodes, the number of guests, the number of books, the number of people I've become sort of engaged with over these years has skewed so much toward advocacy, transportation, the legal aspects, and, you know, the health and well-being of people, as opposed to a lot of podcasts that are focused in cycling on racing or even triathlon or any of, I mean, there are a lot of those podcasts, but I feel right. like I've really found my place with this kind of conversation, and I really enjoy it. And it's always good to talk with you. The other crazy guy I like to talk with is Jeff Speck. He's hilarious.
Jeff is awesome.
He is Jeff, awesome. Yeah.
Jeff has become a very good friend, and I deeply admire him. He's a lot of fun. Yeah.
I think of you two in the same sentence usually. If I'm talking about Chuck Marone, I am usually also thinking about Jeff Speck or vice versa. And I, in fact, last week on the show, I had George Liu, who is the Urban Cycling Institute director. He's out of the Netherlands, although he's kind of stuck in Toronto right now with the, you know, with the COVID-19. But we had a conversation about bicycle highways and the PhD work that he's doing. So it's just, I find it very gratifying and very interesting, and really feel very lucky to be able to know people like you. So I really appreciate it a lot.
Well, thank you.
That's well, thank
kind.
You.
And likewise, I, you know, every time you ask, I always say yes.
Yes, you do.
And, I enjoy talking to you, and we've had some good conversations, and I'm just, you know, it's funny because everybody's doing podcasts now. But you have to be doing something right to get to 500 and have people listen. And I really, it's a great accomplishment. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks
Thank
for,
you.
Thanks for, you know, digging through stuff and being curious and inquisitive and, helping to, share messages with people. It's very important work you're doing. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And we will talk again, of course. And I look forward to the new book, Transportation. Yes, yes. I'm very interested in that. And stay safe, stay well. And I hope we get out to the real world at some point, but in maybe a little different form.
I hope so, too. And I hope to make it to your part of the world when I do.
Oh, that would be awesome. All right. Thank you. Talk soon.
Take care.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. Chuck Marone joined me from his home office in Minnesota. Chuck is the director of Strong Towns. How cool is it that we get to learn about his book first? A scoop. I love it. I am hopeful that as people continue to work from home, drive less, see a cleaner environment, and find new avenues for enjoyment in what might otherwise be a dismal time, Chuck Marone offers us a playbook of sorts to work from the local level, where we live, to fundamentally improve our lives for the foreseeable future. My thanks to both Zach Paschak and Chuck Marone for joining me on the show this week. So last week I asked what food you missed most and to post a picture if you could. There were so many mouth-watering choices, folks. Lots of sushi, probably one of those things I personally would not try to make at home myself, some Indian food, which looked yummy, and more. You can see and drool on our Facebook page if you're interested. I tried to think of a good question this week, and truthfully, just didn't come up with anything earth-shaking. So I'm going to throw it back to you. What would you like to know from other listeners? Ask your question on our Facebook page, and let's see what happens. So that's it. Another episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. Please remember to rate the show on your favorite podcast app and write a short review if you wish. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. Thank you so much for listening. I hope your life is getting back to some semblance of normal, whatever that might be for you. Stay well, stay safe, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.